You're listening to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for tuning in. Every now and then, someone comes along who's so special, so talented, and focused that they change an entire genre. They play with a particular craft, opening up a new way of being, a new way of expressing something. And these groundbreakers don't just do something in a new way. They fundamentally change the thing they are doing. Think about how Michael Jordan changed basketball, how Tom Wolfe changed journalism, or how Jon Stewart changed comedy. These people come from all sorts of places, sometimes unlikely places, and sometimes they're from your own backyard. James DeWitt Yancey was that kind of person for us here in Detroit. While growing up on the city's east side, Yancey, known by many by his stage name, J. Dilla, didn't have a whole lot to his name. He wasn't a rich guy. He didn't have a lot of resources at his disposal. But what he had, he worked with really well. He crafted and tinkered and spent endless hours on his bottomless passion for music. He died way too early at age 32, but he changed the shape of hip-hop and music forever. And that is nowhere near an overstatement. He weaved together a variety of artists from Q-Tip to The Far Side to Common and Erykah Badu in a way that maybe has never been done since. And when you think of hip-hop, when you think of the modern expression of black music in America, whether you do it overtly or inadvertently, you're really thinking about J. Dilla. Because in one way or another, you have heard his work, maybe without even realizing it. Dan Jarnes is the author of a new book that honors the work and legacy of J. Dilla. It is a fascinating read, a deep and compelling exploration of this young man's life and the unbelievable influence he has had on all of the music that we think of as American music today. So I'm really happy to welcome Dan Charnas here to Detroit Today to talk about J. Dilla, to talk about music, and to talk about Detroit. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, and what a thoughtful, beautiful essay that was.
Thank you. I should also say, before we get started, there's no way to have this conversation as though we don't know each other. Dan and I have known each other for several years, and I have been hearing about this book for a really long time. And so I was really, really excited when it came out, and I am equally excited today to have him here to talk about J. Dilla and to talk about this incredible connection he has to all of this music. So Dan, this is going to be fun as well as informative. So
I'm already having fun.
So start here. For people who may not be familiar, who was J. Dilla and why is he so important to the music that I think all of us think of as American music today?
Sure. James DeWitt Yancey, born in Detroit, grew up in Conant Gardens, near 7 Mile, went to Detroit schools, sort of learned how to program a drum machine and became sort of an MC and rapper on the nascent Detroit hip hop scene in the 1990s, and was basically plucked out of obscurity by a very famous rapper producer named Q-Tip of A Tribe Called Quest. And therein launched a brief career, only about 12 years before his untimely death. But that career, though short, really had a tremendous influence, not only on his peers, but on all genres of popular music thereafter, because of a particular rhythmic innovation that the book is named after, that I call Dilettime.
Yeah, yeah. So what is Dilettime? What does that mean?
This is the way that I explain it to my students at NYU. In our popular music, we tend to have two time feels, meaning the ways that musicians sort of relate and feel to time, feel about time. It's beyond, you know, notation. The European tradition has given us straight time, and you know what that sounds like. Mm-hmm. It sounds like one and two and three and four, and where every beat is counted evenly. The American tradition, beginning in the early 20th century, gave us uneven time or swing time. And you know what that sounds like. It sounds like one and two and three and four. And so in our popular music, we've been essentially oscillating between these two time feels, sometimes in the same song. One example that I give is Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen. Pretty much everybody knows that song, where there's this opera section in the middle, and then it switches to rock and roll. And in so doing, it switches from straight time to swing time. And there are lots of other songs that do this, but those were essentially our options in popular music. And I should also say that swing is a retention of African polyrhythm, right? It is a way swing and syncopation in the American context come to us from Africa ultimately, right? But the swing and straight dichotomy didn't change until around 1998, when James Yancey, in a basement in Covent Garden, began to collide those two time feels simultaneously, putting them in conflict with each other, creating this kind of real rhythmic friction that people have tried to put language to. They've called it drunken, sloppy, loping, limping. But it is not sloppy. It is actually intentional. It is a particular groove that came out of Detroit, a particular time field that then other, not only other programmers tried to emulate, but traditional musicians on traditional instruments, drums, bass, keyboards. And that is really what makes this a huge advance in music, I argue.
Yeah, yeah. And for listeners who are, I think, super intrigued by what you just said, tell us where we would find this. Tell us where we would identify it and say, that's Dilla.
Well, the examples I like to use are the first commercial album of a Detroit rap group called Slum Village, of which JD was a member. And that's called Fantastic Volume 2. It came out in the year 2000. But you can also hear it the same year in albums by Common, an album called Like Water for Chocolate, or Voodoo by D'Angelo, on traditional instruments. Musicians putting themselves in rhythmic conflict with each other in ways that were very, very hard to do for a human being. A musician, a drum machine can kind of hold that conflict in place because it's a machine. It's harder for musicians to do that, but it's such an exciting and compelling feeling that musicians like Questlove and D'Angelo and Pino Palladino and Roy Hargrove wanted to do it.
So I want to talk about how important this is to music and to modern music, and especially to hip hop. But I guess the analogy that comes to my mind, you know, is to jazz, and not just in terms of what J. Dilla does for hip hop, but the way he relates to the rest of the artist, the way that he has this profound influence over other artists. And so if you go back to to jazz at its sort of its height in you know, the 50s and 60s. You have all of these artists really experimenting with different things and trying different things and really pushing the envelope in terms of what was quote unquote acceptable in terms of American music. And, you know, you can, if you were to draw it, I guess, on a diagram, you know, there would be all these connections between all the artists, right? Miles and Coltrane and, you know, all the others, they all cross paths. They all even work together, perform together. And I think of hip hop as more distant from that, in the sense that it's more of an individual art. I mean, it is not like the jazz era of the 50s or 60s, but Dilla is that connection between all of those things. He is the sort of singular connection between hip hop artists that you saw between the artists themselves in the jazz era. And to me, that's just fascinating how one person can essentially play the role of many, many superstars, or play the role that many, many superstars did in a different era.
Yeah, a couple of really interesting observations you're making here. I will say that sort of coming up in New York in the late 80s, early 90s, it was a very tight-knit mm-hmm. and close community, even though there were, you know, rivalries and beefs and things like that. Folks really listening to what other folks were doing, mm-hmm. whether it be MCs or DJs or producers. So there have been moments that were very much like, you know, that famous photograph, you know, a day in jazz, or, you know, taking on the Harlem, you know, the stoop of a Harlem brownstone with mm-hmm. the entire jazz community assembled. Hip hop has had moments like that. And Detroit actually had its own moment with the Rhythm Kitchen and the Hip Hop Shop in sure. the early to mid 1990s. But you are correct in that Dilla was a very galvanizing figure, not so much between hip hop producers, although he pretty much has universal acclaim among the great hip hop producers, but a galvanizing fulcrum between electronic producers and traditional musicians. Mm. And, you know, there's this story in the book of this young jazz student from New York who goes to the New School, flying to Detroit with a friend of his who's just gotten signed to Interscope Records, and going to get a beat from JD down in that Conan Gardens basement. And that weekend in Conan Gardens in the basement changes the life of this young keyboardist who we now know as Robert Glasper. Mm. And, you know, what jazz players like Glasper and Jason Moran and many others see in Dilla goes back to what you were saying. They recognize the level of craft. They recognize the willingness to try new things and to experiment, and also a sense of play, right? That there's always this freedom, this fun, you know? Jazz at its best is fun. Hip hop at its best is fun. And if you ask Dilla's younger brother, John, also known as Illa J, why did Dilla do what he did? Why did your brother, you know, why was he attracted to these crazy offbeat rhythms? And he says, we're weird and we like stuff that sounds funny. Right? Sometimes it just comes down to that. But there was a great recognition from musicians to Dilla that he was indeed one of them.
Yeah. Okay, when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Dan Charnas, author of the book Dilla Time, The Life and Afterlife of J. Dilla. We want to hear from you during this conversation as well. Are you a fan of J. Dilla? What did his life and legacy mean to you? Are there particular songs or beats of his that you love and think of when you think of him? You have questions about his life story and his legacy. Also, are there other people who changed the field of a craft that way that you admire? Talk about people who you think are just not just influencers, but shapers of craft. As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Facebook and Twitter, put comments there, and we'll work you into the conversation that way. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today.
WDET is your place for open dialogue.
The music you love.
Real news and in-depth analysis.
And cultural experiences. The sound of Detroit.
101.9 WDET is your public radio station.
This is Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for tuning in. My guest is Dan Charnas, an award-winning music and business journalist and associate arts professor at the Clive Davis Institute of Recorded Music at New York University, and author of the book, Dilla Time, The Life and Afterlife of J. Dilla, the hip-hop producer who reinvented rhythm. We're talking about Dan's book. We're talking about the life of J. Dilla, who was a native Detroiter. And we're talking about the influence that he had over his craft. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call. Tell us what you thought of J. Dilla and his work, what you still think of J. Dilla and his work. Also, tell us what you think of people who really fundamentally alter the space that they're working in, musicians or artists or writers or even business people. Who just kind of rewrite the rules and send everybody in a really different direction than where they were headed. As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Facebook and Twitter, put comments there, and we'll work you into the conversation. Before we get to listeners, Dan, I do want to talk a little more about J. Dilla and Detroit. And in the book, I think one of the great vehicles for talking about Detroit and the influence it had on him before he had influence on our city and the artists here is the relationship that you lay out between him and his mother and the way that she helps him develop and flourish. Talk just a little about that.
Yeah, Maureen Yancey, born Maureen Hayes, Maureen Sherrod, in Black Bottom in Detroit, I believe, in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. You know, she grew up in the first Black community of Detroit before it was, wiped out. James was born in 1974 into a sort of a transitioning Detroit. You know, Coleman Young had just been elected. And there was, despite the fact of what was going on with the global economy and our national politics, there was a sense of hope, I think. Maureen Yancey and her husband, DeWitt, were both sort of, frustrated musicians in a certain way. You know, his father's musical career had been truncated, so he worked the line at Ford, basically, to support the family. And Maureen and DeWitt settled their family in Covent Gardens in the late 1970s. What that meant, essentially, for James and his brothers and sisters, sister, is that there were not a lot of resources for him to develop. It wasn't the same Detroit public schools that Maureen had grown up in that taught her opera. There were just a very different kind of scenario. So there is this moment in the book where he's doing quite well at Farwell Middle School, guided by a excellent music teacher named Peggy McConnell. And he's playing in the Area E Orchestra of the Detroit Public Schools. And after middle school, of course, there's, for all parents whose children are in public schools, where is my child going to go where they can excel? And she lands him at the Benjamin O. Davis Aerospace Technical High School. And it is not Castech. It is not a, it's a decidedly vocational. And it's a place where young Detroiters learn to disassemble and assemble jet engines and work on the instrument panels or the wings of aircraft. And this was the path that Maureen thought that her son James could take to some kind of prosperity in a place where the chances for that kind of prosperity, even working on the line like his father, were diminished.
Yeah.
Ultimately, he bucks that. Ultimately, he finds a mentor in Conant Gardens who's going to let him use his equipment, the very famous Detroiter amp fiddler. And there is some confrontation between him and his mother at that point while he's in high school about what path he's going to follow.
Wow. Wow. And that's such a Detroit story, what you just told. I mean, so many of us have parallels in our lives to that narrative, those of us who grew up in that era. And of course, I'm somebody who's born in the same era in Detroit. And I feel like there is always this kind of lingering influence of that background over the work then, that it's almost as if, and maybe this is a little Detroit conceit, but J. Dilla couldn't have been from anywhere else. He couldn't have done what he did if he wasn't a Detroiter. Am I out of line saying that?
Oh, absolutely. Within line, I think. I mean, there are just some things that I try to identify in this book that make the product of his work a uniquely Detroit product.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes from many different strains. It comes from the fact that he came from musicians. It comes from the fact that music and making music was such a way of life in Detroit. It comes from the arrival of the machine, not just the arrival of the machine in terms of manufacturing, but the arrival of the machine in terms of cultural manufacturing.
Sure. Yeah.
Making and consuming music. All of it is very, very Detroit.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. Let's get to some of the callers. Tim in Hazel Park, you're up first. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks so much, Stephen. Huge fan of the program. And Dan, thanks for this book so we could all fall in love with J. Dilla again. I recently heard you, Dan, on the Dad Bod Rap Pod, and you all were talking about the mythology of Dilla, you know, making donuts on his deathbed, the beat-making monk. And you, as a record industry, you know, former record industry professional, I was thinking about how we box in these singular, like, hip-hop artists. You know, De La Soul is dead after 3 Feet High, trying to make them hippies. Or even Kanye, you're a producer, not a rapper. And wondering, like, if you could reflect on maybe why or how that happened to Dilla. Yeah, thank you.
Great question, Tim. Thanks very much for the call. Go ahead, Dan.
Oh, such a great question. I have encountered, even with the writing of this book, something I'll call the persistence of myth, meaning that this book in a real way disproves some of the myths, one of which, you know, Tim mentioned, that Dilla did not create most of his last album, Donuts, in his hospital bed. But it is a very comforting myth and inspiring myth to people. And so folks will read right past it as almost as if that is not in the book. And so myth does play a huge role in almost everything. And we can even see from world affairs, you know, what's going on in the world right now. A lot of it is sort of battling myths. So the myth of Dilla, I guess I would look to deconstruct it. What is it about this man working until the very end, even from his hospital bed? What is it about that inspires us, that instructs us? What story are we hanging on to? And also, what of our stories are we putting on to Dilla?
Yeah.
Because he was a silent person, mostly, because he was a stutterer when he was a kid. So he evolved this pattern of almost bionic listening. He was an over-listener, you know, an overachieving listener.
Wow.
And so people who don't speak a lot become ciphers for the rest of us. We project our own feelings and thoughts and emotions onto them. And I think in a real way, Dilla was that for us, especially in the hip hop community.
Yeah. Again, Tim, really appreciate the call and the provocative question. Let's go quickly to Ryan on the east side. Ryan, I've only got about a minute and a half left, but to go ahead.
Yes. Hello, Stephen. Uh-huh. So I just wanted to just let you guys know what Dilla's influence was on me. I can remember sitting down at the Detroit Golf Club as a caddy, and my friend and I were debating how the baseline of Get This Money went. And, you know, it was exciting to us because we knew it from the underground, but once we started hearing it on the radio, we were like, oh, yes, this is finally the time that we get our shine. And then I want to also say that, you know, it's, as I'm digging through my crate of Dilla records, or as I knew him, JD, you know, his worldly influence, you know, I'm looking at records from a guy named Spacek from England, if I'm not mistaken. And he did a remix with Daft Punk that most people don't know, you know, but it's also a record that Kanye sampled for a song of his. Mm-hmm. It's just really good to see that he's getting some recognition. I really wish that it was much more when he was alive. But again, as I'm reminiscing and going through these crates, it takes me back to being, you know, 14 years old and hearing him on the radio. Yeah. And then as an adult, you know, listening and collecting the music that he's made.
Yeah. Ryan, I love that you called and shared that. And I think there's so many people in Detroit, and especially from the east side, who have that same feeling and connection with J. Dilla. Okay, Dan Charnas, author of Dilla Time. So great to have you here with us on Detroit Today. Thanks so much for joining.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and to everyone here in our community, you gotta pick up this book and read it. It really is about us as much as it is about J. Dilla. All right, that's gonna do it for us today. We'll be back tomorrow to recap President Joe Biden's first formal State of the Union address. This is 101.9 WDET-FM, Detroit's NPR station. Your connection to news, music, and conversation. We'll talk again tomorrow.